In our study last week, we looked at Galatians chapter 1, verses 11 and 12, and it was my contention that that's Paul's thesis statement for all of the rest of chapter 1 and all of chapter 2. That his point in the first two chapters of Galatians, beyond the introduction and the confrontation, is that the confrontation is crucial because of the nature of the information. The information is from God. So you cannot just ignore it without it being enormously disastrous, quite frankly. And on the other hand, there is this tremendous potential for deepening our ability to live the kind of life that God intends for us to have if we believe what we understand or what we find in these words. So the first two chapters of Galatians is Paul's presentation of why we ought to believe him. I mean, he's a man, but he claims in the first verse of the chapter that he is an apostle, which means he is an authoritative representative of God. And that makes his words the words of God, even though they're coming out of off of his pen as he writes them, out of his mind, out of his heart, nonetheless, superintended by the Spirit of God so that the words are absolutely true, without any qualification. The only caveat in that is words being true and words being understood is not the same thing. The scriptures are true. The understanding we have of them may not be. It may be flawed. In every word that's uttered, there is an automatic necessity for interpretation. We have to take the words that we hear and try to assign meaning to them so that we understand the person who's talking to us. Well, we do this all the time. I told some class I was teaching that was struggling a little bit with the whole idea of Bible study. I said, look, language is the most highly developed skill you have. You've used it ever since you were 2 years old. You're adept at hearing and understanding what you're hearing. This is not a 100% skill because we still misunderstand one another. But the fact is, this is one of the most highly developed skills you have, is the ability to understand words. So the issue of interpretation is an issue, and it is in Scripture a little more difficult because we're not hearing and we can't converse and we can't ask questions and all that and get answers right back. But the fact is, Paul wants us to understand that at least we begin with an inspired, infallible, authoritative, absolutely true revelation of God by God through human instrumentality. What we do with it is another issue somewhat, but that's why we're here, for opportunity to spend some time thinking about what God has said. So the thesis statement in verses 11 and 12 is this: I want you to know, brethren, that the gospel which is preached by me is not according to man. I didn't receive it from a man. I wasn't taught it. I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. So take it or leave it. This is Paul's claim that he is representing God, and he got his message straight from the Son of God. That's the thesis statement for the two chapters. And the critical issue that's involved here is that the whole of our life, everything about our life, is directly affected by the strength of our confidence in its foundations. The reason most people go through life afraid, jittery, nervous, high-strung, bent out of shape, and so on. The reason people get angry easily or frustrated easily is because they don't know with a significant level of confidence what the foundations of their life are. They don't know where their life is rooted. They don't know where it's resting. And because they don't know that, they're very skittish. And that's the way most people live, a very skittish life, because they don't know the foundations. So the reality is, everything about every choice we make, every action we take, every breath we breathe, every day we live, the whole of that is directly affected by the strength of our confidence in the foundations of our life, and the fact that the message of the gospel is ours by direct revelation from the one who is identified in this book as the one who died and was raised on the third day. It's a direct revelation from Him. It's a reality that He died. It's a reality that He was raised again from the dead. It's a reality that He's the Son of God. The revelation is from Him. And it is a revelation that makes life work if we believe the things that are true in that message of the gospel. So, in order to strengthen the Galatians' ability to trust Paul, Paul determined to try to prove that his message is directly from Jesus Christ. Verse 13 is the beginning of his evidences. All the way through chapters 1 and 2, he's going to stack evidences, one on top of the other, that the gospel that is preached by me, he says, is through a revelation of Jesus Christ. You know, anybody can say that. But whether it's true or not, the whole problem. And Paul is saying, I don't expect you to just believe me. I'm going to tell you why you ought to. And so that's the beginning. So this evening what we're going to do is to begin to look at his lines of proof through chapters 1 and 2. And the first line of proof is his claim that this message that he received from Jesus Christ transformed his behavior. That's what the issue of verse 13 and 14 is about. You have heard of my former behavior, my former manner of life in Judaism, how I used to persecute the church of God beyond measure and try to destroy it, and I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries among my countrymen, being more extremely zealous for my ancestral traditions. What he's saying is, you've heard how I used to behave. And the gospel that I received from Jesus Christ that I've given to you is the message of life that transformed my former behavior into what it is now. So his first line of proof is that it transformed his behavior. And that's what we're going to be considering this evening. We're not going to get beyond verse 13 this evening. But I want us to think about what he's doing. First of all, I just want to make this observation. I'll try to prove it in the months to come, the Lord willing. And that is, this is his weakest argument. And the reason why I say that is, Galatians is ordered thematically to prove that his message is direct revelation from God. And he uses several different evidences, several different lines of proof. But he ends up, at the end of chapter 2, arguing that you ought to believe what he says because he had a head-to-head confrontation with Peter, who was acknowledged by all of the church as being one of Jesus' inner circle disciples. He was the one that Jesus had said would be key in the progress of the gospel to the various groups of where the gospel went, Judaism, Samaria, and uttermost part stuff, that Peter was recognized to be a key apostle in the order of God's apostles. And when Paul and Peter went head to head, Peter lost, Paul won. And that's Paul's final argument, that you ought to believe what I'm telling you is the truth because my message confronted Peter and came out on top. That's the strongest argument. That's at the end of chapter 2. So in the beginning, he's going to give us a line of proof, but he's going to keep arguing a little bit by little bit by little bit until he gets to this climax that when his message was compared to Peter's message or Peter's behavior, Paul's message trumped Peter's behavior and Peter yielded on the basis of the message. Which meant Peter believed that Paul's message was true. So that's the way it works. Now this evening what we're going to do basically is just to look in verse 13 at this business of you have heard of my former manner of life in Judaism, how I used to persecute the church of God beyond measure and try to destroy it. In Paul's arguments through these two chapters, the first argument is that the Galatians had heard of his former behavior. Now, keep in mind, Galatia is like here in modern day Turkey. He's talking about events that happened down here in modern day Israel. And I don't know how many miles that is. But I know they didn't have jet planes and automobiles and all that. They didn't even have motorcycles back then. They had camels and donkeys and feet. So if things are going on down here, the chances of them being heard up here are slim to none. I mean, there's a serious question as to whether the Galatians had ever up here heard of Jesus of Nazareth down here, though Jesus of Nazareth is doing some pretty phenomenal things. When you look at the secular historians of the day, Jesus of Nazareth didn't attract hardly any attention historically. So that meant he wasn't perceived to be a big player on a big stage, which meant his behavior and activities and stuff, they were either not heard of or they were rejected as a bunch of baloney. Because, I mean, you know, he was healing and raising the dead and all that kind of stuff. Well, who believes that? So if you had been up here and you'd have heard that, you'd have said, pfft. So when I say this, I'm just pointing out that Paul is claiming in verse 13 that they'd heard of his former manner of life. And I'm wondering, okay, how did they hear that? Now, Paul wasn't a sufficiently big wheel down here in Israel to make any splash up here in Galatia, especially among Gentiles. They could care less about those crazy Jews down there. So the first question is, how can he say this? You've heard of my former manner of life. Well, how they heard really isn't all that difficult if you read the book of Acts. In Acts 22 and in Acts 26, we have two different times where Paul is subject to having to explain himself or defend his behavior to a group. In Acts 22, there's a riot in Jerusalem over Paul's presence there, and they're trying to kill him, and so some Roman centurion tries to... Now, I'm pulling on my memory here, so you can read Acts 22 and see if I've told you the truth later. But some Roman centurion had to get his soldiers in there and protect Paul and get him. But the centurion thought that Paul was some zealot that had created some other problems. He didn't know who Paul was. And Paul asked the centurion if he could address the crowd. And the centurion gave him permission. So he climbed up on some steps where he could talk to the whole group, and he began to talk to them in Hebrew. And of course, that was the language of Judaism, but it wasn't the... They weren't using Hebrew much, except in special cases, because Koine Greek had pretty much taken over, and the dispersion of the Jews had caused most of them to lose their ability to use Hebrew. So when he began to speak to them in Hebrew, it says the crowd got really quiet. So apparently they were not used to being spoken to that way, so they wanted to hear him. And the first rattle out of the box, in Hebrew, he began to explain who he was and what his former manner of life had been. He told them about himself as a way to explain what he was preaching. So he laid out his former behavior, his persecution of this sect called Christianity and all that, as a lead-in to his message. In Acts 26, he's before King Agrippa. And he says, I'm really tickled to be here to defend myself before you, King, because I know that you know all about all these Jewish things. And if I have to explain myself to anybody, I'd just soon do it to somebody who knows all about all this stuff. So, because I know that you know, I mean, this wasn't done in a corner, you know about Jesus and Nazareth and all this stuff, I want to explain to you why I'm here today. And so he begins to tell them about his former behavior, how he persecuted this sect of Christianity and all of that. So I gather from that that was Paul's pretty standard way of preaching the gospel. He would explain who he was as a way to lead into his message. That's my assumption. And therefore, when I read, you have heard of my former manner of life in Judaism, how I've used to persecute the church of God beyond measure and sought to destroy it. I'm assuming they heard that from him. back when he was there before he wrote this letter, when he preached the gospel to them and explained to them who he was and who he represented and how the person he was representing was the Son of God who had died for our sins and was raised on the third day by God to make sure everybody could have a strong enough foundation to believe that. So I'm assuming that they'd heard it from him. But there is another possibility, and that is that those people who came in behind Paul, who began to tell the Galatians that Paul was lying to them, misrepresenting the things and twisting the Bible and all that kind of stuff that they accused him of, they probably had, in a derogatory way, tried to undercut Paul's reputation among the Galatians by telling them what a turncoat he was, how he'd been raised in Judaism and was one of the up-and-coming, you know, and the guy had no loyalty to his own nation, and so he's twisted his own understanding of the Scriptures is just as twisted as his behavior was. So, one way or another, either by his own lips or by his adversaries or both, the Galatians had heard that he was a firebrand and the church of God, known as Christians, was going to get it in the neck if he could make it happen. That's the way he felt about it. So that's the way he was pursuing his life. So how they heard it, you know, if we just take these records from Acts and do a little thinking, we can say, okay, they heard this. They knew that he was a firebrand of Jewishness back before. What they heard is also not terribly difficult because he tells them, I used to persecute the church of God beyond measure, try to destroy it. I was advancing in Judaism beyond most of my contemporaries. Because I was more extremely zealous. I was more zealous than they were. So this is what he's telling them that they have heard. The interesting thing about that is that there are a couple things that stand out. The first one is what they had heard concerned his former behavior in Judaism. He says, you heard of my former manner of life in Judaism. Well, for the Gentiles up here in Turkey, Judaism is a religion down here in Israel that a lot of people have heard about because Judaism was that form of religion that was tied to some fairly phenomenal things that had happened through history. I mean, the Jews may not have been liked, but their God had a pretty big reputation. It kind of ebbed and flowed over the time of history, but nonetheless, there were things that happened because of the God of these people called the Jews. I mean, the Assyrians, for example, wasn't that who Sennacherib was, an Assyrian? He lost almost 900,000 soldiers in one night because of an action that the God of the Jews took. I mean, they were all dead. They woke up dead. Close to 900,000 of them, and here again, I'm pulling the numbers out of my brain or memory, but you can check that story out. And Egypt, all of that stuff that had happened in 1500 BC or so, that wasn't forgotten, totally forgotten history. And then, of course, there's all of this other stuff. So Judaism was not an unknown religion. There were things about it that stood out. But the thing that I want you to understand is that the former behavior in Judaism is a behavior that was former, it was no longer current, and it had its roots in two things that had a real strong connection to Judaism. First, let me say this, behavior, all behavior, past or present, all behavior is rooted in two fundamental things. What a person values and what he believes. Our loves and our beliefs drive all of our behavior. We may not be able to figure out why this particular behavior, like for example eating three pieces of cherry pie on Thanksgiving Day instead of two, or even one, We may not be able to say why eating that third piece, what love or belief is chasing that or driving it, but nonetheless, it's driven. What I'm saying is, we think of things that are valuable and we think of things that are true, sometimes way below our consciousness, so that we just automatically react based on what we really believe is valuable and what we really believe is true. So love and faith are always the driving factors. Every behavior of man is driven by what he considers to be valuable and what he considers to be true. Therefore, the former behavior that is no longer current behavior, in Paul's statement here, had its roots in what Paul formerly loved and what he formerly believed, and it deals with the question of why those former loves and former beliefs are no longer current. How is it that Paul's driven behavior caused by the things that he held to be highly valuable, how come those things are not valuable anymore? What was it that he believed that was driving this behavior that he no longer believes? Because behavior only changes when the values and the beliefs change. That's the only way behavior changes. If you can affect the loves and the beliefs, you can affect the behavior. Well, this behavior, he says, was formerly in Judaism. That's important because as a form of religion, Judaism was extremely concerned with behavior and its impact on others. Two basic others. Judaism was a religion that was rooted in the Ten Commandments, the law given by Moses on Sinai, and all of the extrapolation from those ten that came out to be the first five books of the Old Testament that Moses wrote. That was an explanation of the Ten Commandments, basically. And the Ten Commandments, everybody knows, are ten, you better do this kind of statements. So Judaism was rooted in a religion of behavior demands and how that would affect two kinds of people. One of them was human and the other was divine. How was the behavior going to affect human beings and how is it going to affect God? Well, Judaism was a form of religion that was very concerned about that. The problem with this extreme concern was that by the time Paul was on the scene, after 1,500 years of development of the Ten Commandments down to Paul's day, I mean, a national identity that lasted 1,500 years, finally getting down to Paul's day. In Paul's day, Judaism's focus on how behavior affected others had been turned into an issue of how they were going to react to what you did. In other words, the Jews were consumed with the issue of how are other people going to react to what I do? On the one hand, on the human side, the Jews had turned the law into a way to make themselves very important by their behavior. They would do things to be very impressive to human beings so that those human beings would think that they were some special kind of godly person. That's what they turned the law into, a way of making a huge impression on their fellow man. That's what Paul is saying in verse 14. This striving to be the top dog was the outworking of a religion that said, be very concerned about how your behavior is going to affect people around you. On the other hand, they had turned the law into a way to try to impress God so that he would actually give them eternal life. Judaism was a form of religion that says, if you will be so obedient that you impress God with your obedience, he'll give you heaven as a consequence or as an outcome. So it became a religion of performance and get heaven as an outcome of your behavior. In other words, do good works and God will reward you. That's behavior designed to impress the deity so that he will then react favorably to them. So Judaism had this big, huge focus on doing things in order to impress others. And the problem with that is, that they weren't asking whether the behavior was legitimate. They were asking whether it would be impressive. Now, obviously, with God, you've got to think, in some senses, you've got to think about legitimacy. But quite frankly, they had twisted that so badly that they couldn't even see how illegitimate it was. I mean, Jesus told the story, for example, of the guys, you've all heard the story, where these two men went into the temple to pray. One of them was a tax gatherer, a publican, what, not a Republican, just a publican. And the other one was a Pharisee. He was a real, you know, uptight, righteous guy. And both of them, Jesus said, prayed. The Pharisee, the one who's trying to be impressive, starts telling God how grateful he is that he's not like everybody else. They're all scumbags and he's really good. And he tries to make God believe that he's really good by this. But Jesus said he prayed thus to himself or within himself. And that means his prayer went about this high and then bounced back. He didn't even get to God. Because God's not impressed with that kind of self-glorifying, look how good I am. I'm better than everybody around me. I'm not even like that guy over there. I'm so good. That was their religion. They were trying to be impressive. They wanted the glory that men had to offer, and they wanted the salvation that God would give to those who could impress Him sufficiently with their behavior. So when Paul says, you've heard of my former behavior in Judaism, he's talking about how he behaved as a consequence of a religion that loved certain things and believed certain things. And those certain things were warped. The values were wrong and the beliefs were wrong. But he said, you heard about the life that was driven by these values and these beliefs. And of course, the issue in Judaism is the issue of whether anybody really acquires the goodwill of another by being impressive. Most people who are trying to impress others do. But their impression is very negative. I mean, who really enjoys being around somebody who's so committed to showing how wonderful he is to everybody around him? Most people barely tolerate that. And if they have any Klein genes in them, they don't tolerate it at all. That's just one of our flaws. But the fact is, that's what Paul was saying when he said, you heard of my former behavior in Judaism, because he's saying, you heard how I used to behave. You heard how I used to act. You know that my loves and beliefs were being driven by this religion called Judaism. But not only that, he says, you heard how I used to persecute the church of God beyond measure and try to destroy it, and how I was advancing in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries, being more extremely zealous. I was more zealous than they were. Now, what he's dealing here with is, I'm trying to convince you that my message is true. And the first thing I want you to think about is how I used to behave and why. And I want you to think about not only how I used to behave and why, but I want you to think about how committed I was to acting like that. Because once zeal goes beyond the norm, once he is persecuting beyond measure, once he is more extremely zealous, zeal that goes beyond the norm means that the commitment is very potent, very strong, very great. The level of commitment is very high. Everybody knows that. In our generation in America, they're trying to educate us into not being zealots. They don't want us to be committed to anything, to any serious degree, except being committed to letting other people tell us what's acceptable. In our culture, being a zealot is frowned on. You just don't be really committed to any principle very far, because that just means you don't have any tolerance or patience, you know. Well, in first century Judaism, that wouldn't have flown half a mile before it crashed and burned. Because in Judaism, zeal was considered to be one of the highest levels of desired commitment. You're zealous. You've got to be committed. Even if it kills you, you do this. Because that's what zeal is. Well, everybody knows that once zeal goes beyond the norm, the level of commitment that you're dealing with is extremely profound. In other words, what Paul's loves were really loved. And what his beliefs were held tenaciously by faith. So the loves and the beliefs that were driving his behavior were held significantly tightly by him. And his zeal was critically focused in one direction, according to this text. He wanted to persecute the church of God beyond measure and destroy it. But now, two things. One thing real clear here, and that is, he didn't consider the church of God to be the church of God when he was trying to destroy it. Paul wasn't trying to destroy the church of God in his own mind. He was trying to destroy a group of religious heretics who were undercutting Judaism, and he thought he was doing God a favor by destroying these people. Jesus had actually said that. There will come a time when people will think that they're serving God by persecuting you. Well, Paul was a classic example of fulfillment of those words. But what it means is that he at one time understood the people of God or the church of God to be one group of people. Formerly, it was the Jews. And he said, you know that formerly my behavior was driven by certain loves and beliefs to an extreme degree. I was highly zealous, and my zeal was to eliminate the opposition to God's truth. Well, now, he says, I don't believe that there are God's people anymore. There's a thing called the church, and the Jews don't make up the church unless they are believers in my gospel. And he says, I'm no longer trying to persecute those people, so my behavior has changed radically, which means that my loves and beliefs have changed radically. And the thing I want you to think about, Galatians, Paul says, is this. You have to deal with why I'm so different. Because I'm telling you that I'm so different because the gospel that I got, that I gave to you, that transformed my life, was a direct revelation from Jesus Christ. The reason I'm so different is because Jesus made me different by convincing me that He was, in fact, the Son of God, and that His message of the gospel was absolute truth. He said, that transformed my life. It unhinged my former loves and my former beliefs and just made garbage of them and rebuilt a whole new set of values and beliefs that no longer behave like that. So that's what they'd heard. That's the kind of, I mean, we know how they heard, or at least we think we do, and we know what they heard, because he said so right here. But why? Why is this such a big deal? Why is Paul using this as a proof that his message is true? I think that why they heard what Paul had been like before is at least a part of the crux, the very core of the issue. The issue of a person's behavior involves life, big L, life, eternal life, the life we have as we relate to God, or the life we don't have because we don't have a relationship with God. The issue of our behavior involves this issue of life at a very profound level. We function, our behavior is a function in a cause and effect universe that automatically means that we are going to experience the repercussions of every action that we take. Galatians 6:7 says, do not be mistaken about this. You sow it, you're going to reap it. And all that is the statement that we live in a cause and effect universe. You do this cause and this effect's going to come. That's the way it works. You plant this seed and this plant's going to come up. You sow it, you reap it. Well, because of the issue of our life in a cause and effect universe, our behavior is a critical factor because it is our behavior that kicks the whole thing into gear. And because it takes an action to create a reaction, the action's crucial. And so when Paul starts off by saying, look, I want you to believe this gospel is absolute truth, And I want you to believe it on the basis of this thing, and that is, it has the ability to decide and determine the actions you're going to take. And if it can do that, it's going to control the reactions that are going to come back. And because you live in this action-reaction world, you're going to experience based on the actions and the reactions. And if the gospel can create the actions and therefore dominate the reactions, if you believe the gospel, your life is going to be experienced. It's going to be an experiential reality, a totally different quality than the person whose actions are being taken because they believe some lie, because it's going to cause a reaction that is commensurate to the lie, and the kickback of the reaction on the person who took the action, it's going to cause his experience to deteriorate in quality. So as his experience spins down, his life gets to be worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And why? Because he believes a lie. He values something that's not valuable, and he believes something that's not true, and his behavior is the outcome of that, and the reaction of his behavior is in the cause-effect universe going to kick him in the teeth. Therefore, it's a very critical reality. Because the issue of life is the quality of our experience. I've said this over and over and over and over. The essence of life is joy. If you got it, you've got life. If you don't have it, you don't have it. And it doesn't matter what your situation is. The question is, whether you have life or not. If you can go to heaven and be absolutely absent of joy, you might as well be in hell. And if you can go to hell and be just filled with joy, you might as well be in heaven. Because it's the issue of the presence of joy that makes the difference. It doesn't matter where you are. It matters what you have. And the issue of life is the quality of our experience. And the quality of our experience has to do with what we love and why, what we believe and why, and the behavior that that drives in a cause and effect world. So, the issue then of behavior's impact on our experience is a part of the why. Why Paul is telling them this. It's not like Paul's got a gospel message that people can take it or leave it. It's just kind of interesting religiously, but you know, that's not it. The quality of your experience and mine is directly tied to how much of Paul's gospel truth you have come to embrace so that it governs what you love and governs what you believe. The quality of your life is tied to that. That's what Paul is saying in Galatians. And the issue of behavior's impact on experience ranges in potency. It's kind of like that illustration I used a while ago of eating the third piece of cherry pie. You might be able to tell from that I did that. Point is, it's going to have an impact on our life as a repercussion. But it depends on the potency of it. What I experience from eating a piece of cherry pie is significantly different in potency from what I experience if I kill my neighbor because I got mad at him. The difference is potency of impact on my life experience. I may gain a few extra ounces that I don't need to carry around on my physical frame because I overindulged myself in a dessert. But the consequences of that physically, emotionally, and spiritually are not going to be anywhere near, not even close to near, the consequences physically, emotionally, and spiritually if I murder somebody. So we have all this range of actions from the very minimal impact to the enormously significant. But all of them are governed by what we love and what we believe. And that's why the gospel is so crucial. The biblical principle that talks about this potency thing is established by Paul in 2 Corinthians 9:6. In 2 Corinthians 9, he's talking about financial issues, but he lays out this principle that you will reap according to how much you sow. 2 Corinthians 9:6 says that you will reap according to the amount you sow. If you sow a little, you'll reap a little. If you sow a lot, you'll reap a lot. And that's generally understood, especially by farmers. Just to be a little bit amazed by the fact that when farmers went out to plant the corn, they knew how many seeds per acre they wanted to put in. And sometimes the number was enormous. They were planting those seeds this far apart. And you think, you can't grow corn that far apart. Unless two things. You have adequate water, and you can just pour the fertilizer to it. Because you can grow corn that far apart if it can get enough water and fertilizer to nourish itself. But, you know, if you let it just whatever happens, the soil may be poor and it may be a dry year. And you plant corn that close together and it'll just kill itself off, fighting over who gets the water and who gets the nutrients. They both die. Well, the reason that they had this number count of seeds per acre is because they knew that their result, their return, would be determined by, to some degree, what they put in the ground. And they all wanted to maximize the harvest because corn was worth X dollars a bushel, and you could make bushels to the acre based on how much you planted. So Paul just took that very generally understood physical reality and said, that's true across the board. Spiritually, emotionally, physically, you're going to reap according to the way you sow. Sow a little, reap a little, sow a lot, reap a lot. That's the way it works. The issue, though, is that this return on investment, this, you know, reaping as you sow, means that a person's behavior becomes something that tells others about them. It's not hard to tell what a person's loves and beliefs are in a very big way, because all you got to do is watch what they do. Because their behavior is being governed by the loves and the beliefs and the issue of zeal. How committed are they to these things? It's going to show up in their behavior. And Paul says, it showed up in mine. I was extremely committed at the level of my loves and beliefs, so that it got to be where I was the up-and-coming persecutor of this heresy, now called the Church of God, by a man who's been changed by a message that he received by revelation from Jesus Christ. So one of the big deals here is that the message makes a difference. It produces a set of values and a set of beliefs that, if they're embraced with a certain level of zeal, your life will be transformed by it. So Paul's argument is basically this. The Galatians need to understand that his message affected them, not at a superficial level, but at one of the most profound levels of motivation. Any religion can introduce superficial changes in a person's behavior. Any religion can do that. I mean, if you want to go Eastern on us, you know, you could do the yoga. What are you going to do if you buy into yoga? Well, you know, and do all this kind of stuff, you know. Why? Because what you've embraced is affecting what you're doing. And any religion can affect a person's behavior at a superficial level. Any religion can. But any religion that alters behavior at a profound level has to be explained. Paul is saying, I'm telling you that the message that I preached to you was directly from the Son of God himself by revelation to me. And my first line of proof is, you can see it. You heard about how I used to be, and I was among you. So you could see it. You can see the difference, the transformation. And the argument here is that Paul told them this. The why question, why did they hear this, is so that they would be forced to answer the question. Okay, what made this guy change from being like that to like that? Because what that was and what this is are so different that it just shocks you. He said, you're going to have to answer that question because I'm telling you that it's the gospel that I got from God. Now, that brings up one more issue, and that is that they heard. we've talked about how they heard, what they heard, why they heard, and now we're going to talk about that they heard. That they heard about Paul's former behavior isn't the most critical issue. Anybody can cause others to hear just about anything. I mean, all you got to do, if people can hear things, is talk, and they have heard. So anybody can cause other people to hear, just almost anything. But at the root of that issue of causing people to hear things is this question. Did they believe what they heard? Paul says, you've heard about my former behavior. But what if the Galatians never believed that Paul was like that? Well, then it would undercut the ability to use this argument. Because if Paul didn't really change, if his behavior didn't really change, and that has to be the conclusion you draw if you don't believe this, I mean, if you hear it but you don't believe it, then this real radical change over here isn't all that significant because you didn't believe this anyway. So the real issue is not what they heard, it's what they believed as a consequence of hearing. And that's exactly the issue of the preaching of the gospel. People have heard many, many times the gospel, but that doesn't mean they have bought it, that they believed it, that they embraced it, that it made, I mean, that came across as true to them. Hearing and believing are totally different things. So, the issue for Paul is he's going to assume that they bought his former behavior that they had heard about, that they understood that that's the way he was. He assumes that because if they don't, then his whole argument will collapse to the ground. He can't make the claim that his gospel is by direct revelation on the basis of this proof if they don't believe that he was that way. So that's the issue. That they heard what they heard is not so much crucial as whether they believed it. And in regard to that, they really didn't have any reason not to believe him. Unless the change was so radical that they say he couldn't possibly have been like that. Nothing on this planet can make a guy that was like that, like that. So I just don't believe he was like that. I think Paul was always like this. He was just acting out over there. Or whatever. But let me be real clear here at the end. This principle that behavior is the outworking of what you love and what you believe, and that it argues for the truthfulness of your commitment and zeal to a message, that's a two-edged sword. People intuitively understand that behavior is a critical issue. And they intuitively understand that religion is of no value if it cannot change a person's behavior. It has no power to change a person's behavior. If people intuitively know that, you know what comes out of that intuitive recognition? That statement, well, I'm not going to go over there to that church and be with all those hypocrites. Why would they say something like that? Well, because they see people behaving in a way that says, well, I say with my mouth I believe this and I love this, but I act with my actions like I don't believe this and I don't love that. Kind of like the old man that told me one time, old man, he's probably younger than I am now, but at the time he was old man because I was a young guy, you know. But he told me one time while he was standing this, he had his face right here, and he dipped. So you can imagine what his breath was like. And he had his face right here, and he said, now don't misunderstand me, Darrell. I still love Jesus, I just don't serve him anymore. Say with your mouth, doesn't it? Isn't too impressive. But that dip and that not serving, that's pretty impressive. I said, I know what he really means. He doesn't really love Jesus. He just likes to say that because it makes him feel better. So on the one hand, this thing about what we love and believe showing up in our behavior is real. And it's a two-edged sword because the charge of hypocrisy and the claim to truth both surface regularly. And it's a problem in our generation that so many people claim to be Christians and yet their behavior, I mean, if they were taken to court and tried on the issue, there wouldn't be enough evidence to convict them. You've heard that cliche. But the fact is, it's easy to say, I believe in the gospel of Jesus Christ. The proof of the pudding, though, is in the demonstration. Paul said, the first line of proof that my message is valid is the change it made in me. So, we could turn around and say like this. The fact that there's no change in the person who says he believes a certain thing has no valid basis for expecting me to believe that he believes that message. If it hasn't affected my behavior choices, then the question is, what do I believe and what do I love? And I'm saying that I believe and love that, but my behavior is actually saying, no, I love this and believe that. So it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, it's a strong proof of the legitimacy of the message if the behavior changes from ungodly to godly. But on the other hand, it's a strong detriment for a person to claim he believes something and acts in such a way that it's not true. You can't see it. So that's why it's a two-edged sword. The problem is this, that Paul was fundamentally affected. This issue of being so committed to advancing beyond all his fellow or his kinsmen, that's called the pride of life issue in the Bible. That's a fundamental driver. And Paul's belief in the gospel changed him at that fundamental level. I had a person tell me recently that they didn't know if they could go to a church and week after week and sit and listen to a preacher who was significantly overweight. You know what they were telling me? They were telling me that if a man's a glutton, they're not sure they can trust his message. Why would they say that? Well, because gluttony is at root the lust of the flesh run amok. And if a man's preaching the gospel, but his lusts are not being reined in, what if I believe him? Will I become a glutton too? I mean, if that's what it allows him to be like, then it may allow me to be like that. Same thing's true over and over and over in Christendom, where we have these people who make reputations among men, high reputations, and then they get caught doing some immoral thing, and it just craters their whole ministry and everything. And you have to ask yourself, okay, what impact did that have on the people that were listening to that guy all the time? They didn't know he was like that. Because the fact that they didn't know he was like that didn't mean that it wasn't affecting the way he explained his message and what they were believing. That's a very real and significant thing. So what we're driving at here in Galatians is Paul's first line of proof is the messages of divine revelation, because it makes a significant difference in the lives of those who really buy into it. Do you know what the real miracle in Christianity is? It's not resurrection from the dead. It's the transformation of sinners into saints. It takes a whole lot more power on God's part to get a liar to start telling the truth than it does to raise somebody from some cancer or, debilitating whatever, doesn't it? It's harder to get people who are sinners to start loving the truth and believing the truth than it is to do some powerful, miraculous thing in the physical realm. And that's Paul's argument. My message is true because it affected me at this fundamental level that was driving my behavior. Okay? Questions?